Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about the Supreme Council of the Paris Peace Conference and the different powers that comprise the council, why they were on the council, what they were seeking to achieve, and what difficulties, contradictions, and clashes arose as a result. The Supreme Council was, in essence, the leaders of Britain, France, America, Italy, and Japan, along with their foreign secretaries, which was referred to also as the Council of Ten. By March, and this is, by the way, in January, by March, this had become the Council of Four. Not only had the Japanese removed themselves from the talks, but also foreign secretaries and foreign ministers had also been sidelined, and it was simply a concentrated group of four world leaders: Britain, France, America, and Italy. And finally, the Italians would exit the conversation when it became clear that promises made to them at the Treaty of London in 1915 were not going to be honoured. But we'll come to that later on. The meeting places for the Supreme Council of the Paris Peace Conference were at the staterooms of the Quai d'Orsay, which is the kind of nerve centre, the epicentre of French foreign policy, where the French Foreign Ministry resides. And they would meet at the inner sanctum office of France's Foreign Minister, Stephen Pinchon. And this all played to Clemenceau's strengths. Clemenceau was on home territory here. He was the host of the meeting, just as France was the host of the conference. And it gave him additional leverage when dealing with America and Great Britain. The council would meet daily, sometimes up to 3 times, but mainly once or twice. There was an ad hoc agenda, a kind of a loosely defined set of priorities, but it was never overly formalised or overly prescribed. And this in itself presented difficulties, and it presented opportunities. The powers and nations that were able to lobby hardest with leaders such as Lloyd George or Wilson were able to make sure that their cause edged up the agenda. And issues were dealt with as they arose. So the talks were far from fixed, and it meant that certain matters rarely got discussed. And some issues that were still pressing crises, as opposed to matters to be dealt with in the distant future. For example, ongoing civil war in Russia and the possibility of further wars over the disintegrating Ottoman Empire. These were issues that took precedence periodically, whereas later matters about a final settlement between France and Germany were very difficult to bring to the forefront when crises were being dealt with. The pace of discussions was periodically frenetic, but very often leisurely, everybody was extremely well fed, and various assistants and aides and attachés would drift in and out with maps and documents and all the information that the Allied leaders needed to make decisions about the future of Europe and indeed the rest of the world. Now, the problem that they all face is that the clock is ticking on their power. Their forces are demobilising rapidly and the power is shrinking on a daily basis. General Pershing told Colonel Edward House, Wilson's top advisor, that in spring 312,000 troops will be sent back to America in January. The record last month, it was 300,000. At this rate, all our troops will be in the United States by August the 15th. So that gave Wilson a very clear picture of how quickly he had to impose peace terms on Germany and the other defeated Central Powers. And all of them were aware that not only were there revolutionary uprisings happening across Europe throughout 1919 and the possibility of others from immense anger and resentment amongst civilian populations, armed services and particular industrial groups such as, for example, in Britain, miners, but also hunger and the possibility of famine in Europe and outbreaks of epidemics such as typhoid and cholera and, of course, the Spanish flu that was sweeping the world, gave the peacemakers of the Supreme Council the impression that there really was precious little time to save what remained of Europe at all. Very little seemed to materially have taken place since the end of the war, since the armistice in November 1918. And there was a perhaps explanation for this in that the Allies had not envisaged the fighting to end so quickly. The difference between the Paris Peace Conference and the wartime conferences in the Second World War is it was abundantly clear from 1944 onwards that the Axis powers had lost the war, and the British, the Americans and the Soviets had all had well over a year to plan the shape of a post-war settlement, or to be discussing it between themselves. Immense energies had to be poured into winning the war in its final year, from spring 1918 up to early summer. It looked entirely possible as if the war in the West was lost, as the Ludendorff offensives, the four offensives from Blücher, York and Michel, seemed to push the British back almost to the coast and divide the British and French armies. And the collapse of the Ludendorff offensive and the full retreat of the German army by October 1918 was unprecedented and something that could barely have been imagined or planned for. So the collapse of Germany led to a peace and an armistice happening at a far greater pace than the Allies could plan for. Hence, by December 1918, January 1919, there's still so many unanswered questions about what to do with the peace now that it had actually arrived. Now, in Margaret Macmillan's excellent revisionist history of the Paris Peace Conference, Peacemakers, 1919, she quotes Winston Churchill. Churchill said, of the war, "What had we to do with the peace? Well, we did not know whether we should not be destroyed. Who could think of reconstruction while the whole world was being hammered to pieces, or of demobilisation when the sole aim was to hurl every man and every shell into battle?" While the war was raging, of course, all sides had visions of what they wanted the peace to look like. Some foreign ministries across Europe and America had old visions and plans that could be dusted off. Some had new ideas about what opportunities could come for the war, particularly the view that Lloyd George had that there were plentiful opportunities in the now defunct Ottoman Empire. The British set up in 1917 the Special Inquiry, and the American Inquiry that was set up in September 1917 was set up under Colonel House. Both these inquiries had experts from historians to diplomats to military figures, even to missionaries. And they produced various studies about what could be achieved from the peace. In the United States, there were 66 reports on what to do about Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And there was an awful lot of information about the British Empire, in point of fact. And it was assumed that in one set of plans that perhaps the war would see the end of the British Empire. However, despite all this planning, most of the Allied leaders, in fact all of them, had seen relatively little of it. They had been, as we've said, occupied with winning the war. And by the time the Paris Peace Conference begins, it's only really Wilson that's had the opportunity, whilst sailing across the Atlantic in the George Washington, to have any kind of quality time, as it were, to look at maps, plans, reports, or anything like that. And he doesn't even really do much of that while he's on his journey. He spends a lot of time in his stateroom, not doing much of anything at all, leaving it to his 100-strong team to do most of the working out. They were visiting his chambers on the George Washington, asking him really to be involved, to make some decisions and to tell them what he wanted and what he envisaged, not to much avail. And this led to a problem of conflicting priorities. Because you had three or more world leaders who were partly shooting from the hip and whose formalised set of plans were not in any way in sync with one another, when you have Clemenceau attend the conference and his sole objective is to punish Germany and to secure France's eastern borders, the number of places down the list that the League of Nations comes is so significantly far that the President Woodrow Wilson rejects France's agenda out of hand and says that it is purely skewed towards French priorities and will not do. And this raised the second problem as to how decisions would be reached. There was no clear mechanism as to voting rights or who had a majority say at the table. And this was probably more a reflection on the manner in which previous conferences, if you look at the Congress of Berlin or the Congress of Vienna in the 19th century, had operated. They had been the meetings of great statesmen who horse-traded things between one another in a very informal, port and cigars kind of way. And the new Paris Peace Conference that was in the full glare of world scrutiny and involved powers who had been immensely democratised in the half century since the Congress of Berlin.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
40 years or so since the Congress of Berlin, it was very difficult to have quite the same sort of backroom dealings. Not to say that those didn't take place at Paris, because they certainly did, but the mechanism for decision-making had to be quite different. All the Allied powers were invited to the conference, which actually turned totaled some 29 powers. And there were powers, for example, like Siam, Liberia, who had fought on the Allied side. And the question was, would they have an equal vote compared to the British Empire delegation? Would, in fact, the entire British Empire be outvoted by a combination of Siam and Panama? Woodrow Wilson was quoted as saying, "We ought to have no formal conferences, but only conversations." To which Clemenceau thought that this was ludicrous, it would drag out the proceedings almost indefinitely, and it would make sure that the public, who in France were very keen on revenge on Germany, and in Great Britain as well, in fact, would feel very disappointed that no concrete action against Germany was being taken. Wilson had no intention of allowing lesser powers to derail the conference or to take away control of the agenda. It was going to be his moment to try to push through the League of Nations. But France had a long list of issues that they felt was completely irrelevant. They didn't wish to discuss the League of Nations, Poland, Russia, the Baltic states, the aftermath of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Balkans. They didn't see issues pertaining to the Far East or the Pacific as being particularly important, or Jewish affairs and the Palestine Mandate and the Balfour Declaration. They weren't that concerned in discussing international river navigation, which was something that Wilson suggested would be a great way of diverting lesser powers. So the smaller countries, as they were previously mentioned, could be engaged in conversations over things like such as water navigation or the control of international railways, the legislation to make sure there was self-determination. These are issues that the French didn't want to discuss either. Protection for minorities. And it's a terrible irony, really, that the question of self-determination and the question of ethnic minorities, these are precisely the issues that Hitler would later use in order to unpick the Treaty of Versailles and to launch a second war in Europe, which France obviously suffered. And questions of patents, trademarks, war crimes, reparations, and economic and financial questions. The one thing that the French wanted to be discussed more than anything else was the treaty with Germany, which would really make up the mainstay of the Treaty of Versailles. This, as I've said, was an international conference unlike any other. The Congress of Berlin was attended by various correspondents and satirists from magazines such as Punch, for example, who wrote all sorts of amusing cartoons about Disraeli and Lord Salisbury. But in real time, with the use of telegraph and modern means of mass communication and mass printing, the whole story of the deliberations at the Paris Peace Conference was relayed back to populations across Europe and in the United States and across the rest of the world in real time. That people were finding out day by day what was being discussed and deliberated. And this had never happened before. And this places world leaders in connection with their populations and in complicated power relationships with mass populations back home, in ways which had never existed before, and it kind of clips their wings a little bit. It makes sure that they are responsive to the whims of the people they serve, and the responsive to ideas of national pride and irredentism, say, for example, in the case of Italy. And revenge, in the cases of France, to some extent Great Britain as well. And this also, this kind of constrains the hands of various world leaders at the conference. One of the most significant outpourings of public anger during the Paris Peace Conference happens in China during the May the 4th movement. The May the 4th movement, or the May the 4th protests, explode in rage across Beijing and countless other cities in China when it turns out that Britain and America and France and the rest of the Supreme Council have sold China down the river and agreed to Japan's control of the Shandong Peninsula. Now, if you go back one or two podcasts, I did a thing about Japan in the First World War and about the claims that Japan makes over China and the 21 demands and the 13 demands. And the position that China is in when it comes to the peace conference. And the direct democratic effect on Chinese people when they hear that the conference that they had longed for had stabbed them in the back. Many Chinese people cheered the end of the First World War, not because Chinese soldiers have been fighting it, other than obviously the general labourers have been treated extremely badly on the Western Front, but they cheered it because they thought this was an end to a particular phase of history. It would be a conference where a fair deal for countries like China would be called, and the Chinese people would be then freed of Western imperialism, which obviously doesn't happen. Lots of journalists moaned about the fact that the proceedings were very secretive. Wilson had said that he wanted open covenants in his 14 points, but this didn't include things being open to press scrutiny. Wilson said that there shouldn't be no more secret treaties, but this didn't mean that the public and the press would be there to pick over the bones of anything a politician said while in conversation with another world leader. There were widespread agreements coming from Clemenceau and from Lloyd George, who believed it was ludicrous to allow every decision that was being made to be reported on every single day. And Lloyd George said that there should be some kind of press management, a daily press release. The British had obviously been the masters of press management during the First World War and had managed to harness public relations in a way that no other power had come close to. This was generally agreed, and Wilson thought it was a good idea. The American Press Corps don't. The American Press Corps believed it was their democratic duty to report back to the American people precisely what it is Wilson was agreeing to, because they didn't trust him. The American newspaper men looked upon Wilson as being a naive fool, and Clemenceau and Lloyd George as a couple of wily Europeans who would tie him in knots if he wasn't exposed to public scrutiny and decisions that Wilson was making couldn't later be revoked. And this is a general view of Wilson that perpetuated throughout the press and throughout large sections of the American population, that he was a high-handed idealist, a high-minded idealistic man who was capable of great folly. Now, if you look at Adam Tooze's history of world history from 1916 to 1931, The Deluge, very different a picture of Wilson emerges, quite a canny operator who's not there to sell American interests down the river in the expectation that he will create some kind of delightful liberal world order. Now, here really is a great American salesman, a guy who's there to get what he can for American commercial interests, particularly access to world markets and the freedom of the high seas, which was then the only challenge to America at that point would have been Britain's Royal Navy. Some powers hope for a greater degree of proportionality. Brazil, Portugal, for example, had only one delegate. Portugal had sent 60,000 soldiers to the Western Front, and the Portuguese main rival to the negotiations was Brazil. Portugal was an old friend of Great Britain, and the United States was supporting Brazil. And the Brazilians had managed to send one medical unit and a couple of pilots to the Western Front. And they wound up with three delegates. But that was judged on the size of population. On that basis alone, democratic basis alone, Brazil seems to have a strong argument. The collapse of Russia, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire meant that there were all sorts of states that were emerging and hadn't quite fully emerged by the end of the peace conference. So who was to represent them? Countries like Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia. To which Lloyd George said, "The task of the Paris treaty makers was not to decide what, in fairness, should be given to the liberated nationalities, but what, in common honesty, should be freed from their clutches when they had overstepped the bounds of self-determination." And that tells you that Lloyd George saw new countries like Yugoslavia, Poland, and Czechoslovakia not as equal participants at the Paris Peace Conference, but as nations to be formed and then sometimes to be slapped on the wrist if they took what he thought or what the Supreme Council thought didn't belong to them. Now, I'm going to continue this in a little while. We are going to look at the Supreme Council and how it responded to subjugated, colonised peoples such as India, the Kurds, and the Vietnamese, or the Indochinese, who had come to the Paris Peace Conference looking for justice and freedom. Anyway, thanks very much. I hope you've enjoyed this. And all remember, catch us on our Patreon page. And if you can give us a write-up on iTunes, be very grateful. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.